dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks, and welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank. If you enjoy what you hear here today, go ahead and check out my Twitter feed at @Uncle_Jimbo. A lot of pain for the other side going on there. Well, the Democrats are at it again, or I should say still at it. They refuse to accept that they lost this presidential election and the last four in Congress. The current focus of their unhinged aggression is Representative Devin Nunes, chairman of the House Select Committee on Intelligence. Now, he has drawn their ire for the imaginary crime of investigating why Democrats were spying on candidate, then-president-elect Donald Trump, and leaking classified information to smear him. Instead, they wish he was helping them smear him with garbage accusations about Putin and Trump colluding to sell American democracy to the Russians. So now the Dems had 6 months during the last bit of the Obama regime and the election to look at everything they could find and leak it in classic smear fashion, knowing that accusations about Trump and Russia would get covered by their partners in the media, and the fact that they could find zero instances of any collusion, just the horrifying fact that Trump knows and works with people who do business in Russia. The horror. Now they are trying so hard to keep the momentum of this baseless attack going, and they honestly believe in their deluded little hearts that they can take Trump out, impeach him, and place Hillary on the throne so unfairly stolen from her. You know, it would be comical if they weren't actually destroying our national security in the process. You know, not just trying to stop Trump from governing in any effective way, but they're empowering our enemies as well. By continuing to proclaim that Putin can control American elections and decide who is president, they make him bigger and badder than he actually is. I mean, of course the Russians were messing around in our politics. They have been my entire life. It's what they do. But now the Dems are telling the world that Putin is in charge and actually runs the United States. They've taken sour grapes over an election where their awful candidate lost and turned it into a windfall for the Russians they don't deserve. I mean, does anyone not think Putin isn't already taking advantage of this in power games all over the planet? Don't screw with me. I am the boss of America. Thanks, Democrats. So let's get back to Representative Nunes, who had the audacity to decide that instead of joining a witch hunt against our duly elected president, he would instead point out, hey, there's a witch hunt against our duly elected president. He looked at the leaks of classified intelligence information that were supposed to destroy Trump and said, hey, aren't those leaks of classified information? Isn't that a crime? And he began to do his job and investigate. So he said, hey, aren't the Democrats and their media allies making all these bogus claims about Trump and Russia based on classified reports and surveillance? Isn't that illegal? You know, I thought you couldn't spy on U.S. citizens or use our spying on foreigners to illegally target U.S. citizens or unmask the identities of U.S. citizens out of wiretaps and other surveillance, especially to use those things for partisan political attacks. Huh, I should take a look at that. And when he found that some of this wasn't even related to Russia, it was just Obama officials using foreign intelligence to target Trump, his associates, and even his family, he went and told the president this was happening, and he would investigate. How dare he? Well, as the British Special Air Service says, who dares wins. And now we're going to find out which Obama officials were doing this, and God willing, and the creek don't rise, maybe see some of them pay for this criminal injustice and attack on our democracy. Now let's shift gears and talk about the upcoming endgame against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Now we're getting there. We may actually see the black flag of the caliphate cut down. But in the course of that, there is some ugly urban combat to root out the last elements of ISIS from their positions among civilians. Now, the U.S. military confirmed that it conducted an airstrike in Mosul, where reportedly more than 100 civilians were killed. Now, there are still more questions than answers at this point about what actually happened, but this requires us to think about what are acceptable levels of civilian casualties in combat operations. Now, it's an eminently reasonable and moral idea that the death of civilians in war is horrible, and we should do everything possible to ensure it doesn't happen. But should we do everything possible to avoid it? Because everything would mean refusing to conduct military operations unless we have certainty there are zero non-combatants in jeopardy. Now, U.S. officials have said this particular airstrike was requested by Iraqi forces in response to sniper fire from rooftops of the buildings that ended up getting bombed. This is a pretty common tactic, and we employ airstrikes to avoid having to clear each building in house-to-house combat. U.S. airstrikes can hit very precise targets, and it's possible to take out the enemy with minimal collateral damage. But the large number of casualties in this relatively small area leads to the question of why were there so many people gathered there? It's possible that the buildings in question served as some type of shelter for civilians. We didn't know that. It's also possible that ISIS herded non-combatants into those buildings. In either case, if ISIS then placed snipers on the rooftops of those buildings and attacked coalition forces using innocent civilians as armor, they are guilty of a war crime. ISIS bears the moral and legal responsibility for those civilians who died. And it's not difficult to envision that scenario, given the barbaric and ruthless nature of the jihadists who fight for the Islamic State. They have shown time and time again that the lives of innocents mean nothing to them. They have killed civilians in every horrific way conceivable, using them to create a tragedy they can blame on America and the coalition forces, aids ISIS in slowing the advance, now pushing them from their self-proclaimed caliphate. Placing civilians as human shields aims at disabling our military operations in combat. If ISIS can paralyze coalition forces out of fear that our most effective actions may have tragic consequences, they can force us to stop fighting them or put our own troops in greater danger. The recent raid in Yemen that has caused so much controversy is another good case to examine. Yes, civilians died in this operation as well, but the troops on the ground reported there were many women firing at them, which makes them combatants and legitimate targets. And again, the enemy forces put themselves in the middle of civilians and created the danger to those innocent lives. The priority of taking action now to stop greater harm in the future is being taken hostage by a misguided notion that we can somehow conduct perfect military missions. We can't operate on the standard that no U.S. personnel or civilians should ever die while we fight an enemy who will kill as many of both of those as possible if not stopped. That's a recipe for short-term comfort and safety and long-term regret for the bloodshed and butchery we could have prevented. Of course, we must seek to minimize the number of non-combatants killed during combat operations. Our enemy currently observes none of the rules of war. and if anything, operates in direct contravention of them and civilization in general. That doesn't absolve us from our responsibility to respect the value of life. If anything, it reminds us to. It should not cause us, though, to shy away from making the difficult decisions that may cause the deaths of innocents now in order to save the lives of more in the future. I'm Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're talking right now with Rowan Scarborough, national security reporter at the Washington Times and author of a couple good books, Rumsfeld's War, The Untold Story of America's Anti-Terrorist Commander, and Sabotage, America's Enemies Within the CIA, which seems to be actually far too accurate right now. But Rowan, I wanted to talk about a piece you wrote that in some ways seems to have been part of getting the United States Army to do something smart. There was apparently there was an Army public affairs sergeant who was in trouble and potentially getting booted out of the military for essentially revealing the same information or passing around the same information that Obama was crowing about regarding the bin Laden raid. Can you tell us what was happening and hopefully what the change to that might be?
That's right. This sergeant, 13-year sergeant, three times deployed to Iraq, a cancer survivor, basically was at the 160th Special Operations Regiment as their public relations person. He saw a Boeing article, internal article, that mentioned that the 160th did the bin Laden raid and alerted his boss, hey, we have to get them in an email. He said, hey, they need to take that line out of the story because DOD has never acknowledged that. Boom. Just by putting that in an army.mil email account, his superiors came down on him and gave him a reprimand. And when the Army a year later went to start to call the force because they have too many soldiers, they used that as an excuse to kick him out because he got that one bad performance evaluation based on trying to do the right thing. And so here he is at Fort Bliss now. He had 3 or 4 days before they were going to transition him to civilian life. And I was turned on to the story by the Terrorism Law Center at St. Mary's in San Antonio. And I wrote a story. It appeared Monday and boom, 3 or 4 hours later, Big Army in Washington called Fort Bliss and said, put his discharge on hold. We're going to review the whole case. Ricardo Branch is his name. And he really, I went through his NCO evaluations and everyone was sterling, except for that one hiccup when he tried to do the right thing. And in his email, I mean, President Obama went to Fort Campbell, personally thanked the 160th and 2011, came out and praised them in public. So if the commander-in-chief can basically say these guys did the mission, why are you crunching a poor sergeant who just put it in an official email to try to stop it from being publicized? That was the craziness about this case.
You know, and Rowan, I don't think there's anybody with an above room temperature IQ who didn't know it was 160th. They're the ones who fly all the special op missions. There isn't another special ops unit that flies the tier one missions. So, I mean, you know, even if Obama hadn't done it, even if it wasn't common knowledge, it was in a million news reports about it. And this guy's just basically trying to police up a contractor who's using it for promotional materials. Is that what Boeing was up to?
Boeing wanted to put that in for an article about their work with the 160th. Yeah. You're right. Weather helicopter did not take them into Abbottabad.
Exactly.
There's only one team that can get them in there. It was in all the newspapers. And the poor guy has been through a lot with cancer in his three deployments. And I looked at his last evaluation when he was in South Korea, and it was a 1-1, as they say in the NCO world.
Yeah.
Just excellent ratings for what the guy did. So he's been treated unfairly.
We're talking with Rowan Scarborough of the Washington Times. And Rowan, you've got another piece that was about Adam Schiff and the Democrats
and this garbage dossier of information that was created as opposition research against, at that time, candidate Trump. They wouldn't stop. They kept pushing it, and eventually, you know, BuzzFeed and CNN kind of collaborated to break it into the news. And with Representative Nunes's, you know, revelations that this really was a full-on Democrats in the administration helping the Clinton campaign attack candidate Trump. Tell us a little bit more about what this actually was, and if they're still trying to make hay with this garbage document.
Sure. You know, the infamous dossier was part of Democratic opposition research. They hired an ex-spy in Britain. They gave him a couple hundred, $300,000 to find dirt on Trump. And he produced these memos with bizarre allegations. And even the liberal media said that they could not confirm any of this. Even Obama's intel chiefs, the DNI, Michael Morell, who was the deputy director, have gone on TV and said, we could not confirm what is in this dossier. In fact, it appears that he paid intermediaries to give him information that he then put in the dossier and sent to Democrats. And yet, when they had their first public hearing, the House Intelligence Committee, on the Russian connection, what did Democrats do? Adam Schiff and others on they embraced the dossier like it was some government white paper that had been through all sorts of rigorous study. And they just started mentioning names and meetings and things that have never been confirmed, things that the people who were targeted say, this never happened. I never met this person. And it is all part of the Democrats' campaign to get an independent commission established, which would basically keep Trump on the defensive his first 4 years. And that's what they're after. And if it means quoting a discredited dossier, they are willing to do it. And I invite people to read the transcript of that Monday a week ago hearing and how many times Democrats referred to the dossier as if it was truth, when you know some of these things, like Trump's lawyer meeting in Prague with Russian intelligence, that was in the dossier. It's fiction. The guy was in L.A. at the time. He's never been to Czechoslovakia in his life.
If a senator or a congressman says something in any way, that's newsworthy. And then they can report on that and say, Representative Adam Schiff, in a hearing in the House Intelligence Committee, read a garbage document today that you guys should listen to. And it doesn't matter to them that it's not true, because like you said, it keeps Trump on the defensive. And they're doing the same thing now to Representative Nunes. They're attacking him for essentially doing whistleblower protection of information about Democratic operatives, again, attacking President Trump and his family and the rest by unmasking their names from classified intelligence reports.
Nunes is trying to do what the White House asking to look to, besides the Russian connection, what was the degree of surveillance of the Trump transition team? Given the New York Times January 20th, Inauguration Day report, wiretap, Trump aides wiretapped right in the headline, and all these stories about the names of Trump people picked up in surveillance. Given that article, will you look into what was done during the transition? And Nunes is actually doing it. Lo and behold, he actually went to a skiff on White House grounds so he could look through a secure computer at some of these documents. And I think he's to be commended for trying to get to the bottom of it. But he's off message. See, the message is Russian Trump collusion. And
right,
that's the only storyline there is. So if you veer from that, then you need to recuse yourself. And so that's what he's facing today.
Is there any chance he's likely to actually recuse himself and have to cave to this attack?
I guess there's a chance. They got Sessions to back off, right? But Nunes seems pretty adamant that he's going to run this committee. And if they don't want to have any more hearings, so be it. We won't have any more hearings. I think Paul Ryan said just bluntly, no, I'm not thinking of replacing him. You can't. The Democrats still think they're running Washington. That's part of the problem. And we know if a Democratic chairman wanted to go look at some executive office computer computerized reports that you can only look at on specialized networks, no one would care if it was a Democratic chairman trying to protect Obama. Nobody would care. But Nunes went off what is the New York Times media official storyline narrative, and that was his death.
Well, it's sad to watch, but in the end, I think you hit the nail on the head. The Democrats are no longer running Washington. They got a pretty decent stranglehold on the judiciary, though. Rowan Scarborough, national security reporter at the Washington Times, thanks so much for keeping everybody's feet to the fire.
My pleasure.
This is Jim Hansen. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. We'll be back after the break.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank. We're going to talk right now with Tom Spohr, who's a retired lieutenant general from the United States Army and currently the director at the Center for National Defense of the Heritage Foundation. Tom, welcome to the show.
Jim, thank you very much.
Well, I wanted to pick your brain a little bit. We are, I hope we are reaching something resembling the end game in the fight with the Islamic State. But I don't think toppling and cutting down the black flag is the end of that battle. The New York Times has recently been calling for a declaration of war or perhaps some flavor of an authorization for the use of military force specific to the current situation. And I wanted to see what your thoughts were on that and how that might affect what we're doing currently.
Yeah. Jim, I support it. The authorizations for military force that we're working under now date from 2001, 2002. So, you know, 16 years ago. The members of Congress that voted on that now, 75% of them are gone. So only 25% of the people in Congress are still remain that actually voted for that prior use of force. And so, you know, I think it's always, as a former military officer, I think it's always good that we enter conflict, go to war, with the support of Congress, and that this authorization is becoming a little dated. So I think it would be very useful for us to update our use of our authorization for the use of military force, get a little debate going, and see where it goes.
Now let's talk a little bit about that, because the current one was more or less aimed at Al-Qaeda and offshoots and things like that. Obviously, there is an ideological brotherhood between, you know, the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and some of the other jihadist groups. But do you think this should be somewhat narrowly tailored at taking down, you know, the caliphate, their Islamic State in Iraq and Syria? Or should this actually address the, you know, some of the other groups, or the fact that some of these groups, even though they may not be affiliated, all seem to have similar goals?
Yeah, and so it's a balancing act of being too narrow or too broad. If it was me writing it, I think I'd say something like I'd put the Taliban down because we still are fighting them. I'd put Al-Qaeda down. I'd put ISIS down. And I'd say something about, I don't know, their direct progeny or their offspring or their cousins or something like that, so that if a new group formed tomorrow and they came up with a new name, you know, we wouldn't have to run back and get a new authorization. So I wouldn't make it everybody that we might pick a fight with, but I'd start there.
I think that's wise, given it, we could play whack-a-mole, and all they have to do, you know, at some level is reform, like you said, because if we kick them out of Raqqa and they reconstitute in Libya, are they the same group? You know,
yeah,
and do we
exactly
have to go ahead and redo that? Now, let me ask you, let's look a little bit at the end game as it currently is unfolding, because, you know, we're working our way through Mosul. It's messy, and I think ISIS is doing everything they can to up the rate of civilian casualties. I think they may have baited us into hitting that building with the airstrike just this last weekend, and they're going to make this an ugly thing. If we do manage to, in conjunction with the Iraqis and the, you know, the militias and everyone who's in the coalition, push them out of that, who's going to rule? Can the Baghdad government actually make a legitimate, you know, ruling coalition with the Sunni still to take care of Anbar province?
Yeah, I think, you know, Mosul's up not in Anbar, but I think there's probably a government, you know, in refugee camps still around. You know, the mayor and all those people are still there. So it's just a matter of establishing order and putting back the people that were in charge years ago. I'm not terribly concerned about that. You know, it's going to, like you kind of allude to, though, there's a humanitarian crisis there. And so it's not like Fallujah or Ramadi. Those were towns in the hundreds of thousands. You know, Mosul, a town of 3 million, like you say, going to be just devastated by the time this fight is over. It's going to require a lot of work to get those people resettled. I mean, we want them back in their city. We want them back with some semblance of employment, some hope that things will get better. Otherwise, they'll become refugees as well. I think that's the big work ahead of us.
And I think with Mosul and some of the other areas where they have, you know, a big population excursion, that's a huge issue. We're talking with Tom Spohr, director at the Center for Natural Defense of the Heritage Foundation. But Tom, my concern with Anbar is the fact that because, you know, ISIS was and is a Sunni insurgency, and they have devastated the ruling class there. You know, they took it there, you know, took the tribal sheikhs and the rest of the folks who generally would be running things there and have killed most of them. My concern is with, you know, the Iranian influence with the Baghdad central government and the fact that a lot of the troops that have been conducting the clearing operations have been either, you know, the Shia militia or allied with it, that we may have a difficulty, you know, getting the Sunni population of Anbar back into, you know, control without a giant boot on their neck.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair concern. I don't think the Shia, I don't think Baghdad, even the Iranian militia, I don't think they've got much interest in getting and controlling those towns in the Euphrates Valley. That's some fairly sparse and barren kind of area out there. I think they'd probably be content if the Sunnis can reform their government, try and slowly put their towns back together.
Well, there's no oil, so they really, you know,
yeah.
That's
yeah,
the big
no
thing.
There's no natural resources. The dilemma has been, you know, the Sunnis do not feel like they're at all part of the Iraq government. You know, they're on the fringes of it, so they feel like they have no political voice, and that, to some degree, continues. That's the problem that's kind of pulling Iraq apart.
Well, talking about Iraq being pulled apart, you know, obviously the Kurdistan regional government is a nation state in everything but, you know, actual recognition of that. Is it worth trying something similar, some sort of autonomous zone for the Sunni regions to at least give them the feeling? Because like you said, they don't have any allegiance to Baghdad. They don't feel, you know, when in 2008 we promised them we'd make sure Baghdad treated them decent. Obviously, that never happened. ISIS has destroyed them. Is there a decent case to be made for some higher level of self-government for those regions?
I think there is. I mean, the obvious dilemma, as you mentioned earlier, is there are no natural resources out there. So unlike Kurdistan, they can't really be self-supporting out there. There's not much going on. And so they're going to probably need some help from the central government in order to stay viable out there and maintain some level of basic services. You know, we've seen this happen before. The former Yugoslavia kind of broke into its little pieces, and I guess that's going okay. I mean, so that could potentially work for Iraq. You hate to see it fragment too much into little tiny provinces, because then it's not going to be able to stand as strong as it and, you know, be a nation state against its neighbors like Iran and other people. But yeah, that is a possible alternative.
And again, you've got you know, the other major players. You've got Turkey with their difficulties with, you know, the greater Kurdistan, not just the KRG there in Iraq, but the fact that they have a couple of scraps going on with Kurdish groups. And then the Russians supporting Assad in Syria, but there's the rest of the ISIS-controlled areas, which have a lot of Sunni population. So is there a possibility of that border, which ISIS kind of erased over the past couple of years between Iraq and Syria, potentially becoming a greater Sunni area?
That's possible, I guess. You know, anything's possible, especially when you bring Syria into the mix. You know, there is no real consensus on how that will turn out or even should turn out, and who should govern Raqqa when Raqqa falls, and what's going to be in place of Assad out there. And so, you know, I mean, there's a whole range of alternatives, and nobody has really advanced a legitimate, viable alternative, I think, to what comes next in Syria.
Yeah, I think we kind of operated in a vacuum for a large portion of the past 8 years, given the fact that Obama wasn't prosecuting the war particularly vigorously. And certainly I haven't heard any plans, like you said, to push for a post-conflict strategy. And again, as we discussed at the beginning, perhaps an authorization for the use of military force could contemplate an end state as well, so we at least are not making this an open-ended conflict for that. Tom Spohr, Director of Center for National Defense at the Heritage Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney doing Secure Freedom Radio. We will be back after the break.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with Mike Waller, who is a vice president at our own Center for Security Policy, and a guy who's been keeping a weather eye on our good friends, the Russians. And Mike, like most of us who've been keeping an eye on the Russians for a long time, we know they're not our friends. But I've been hearing an awful lot of speculation and conspiracy mongering and just complete garbage talk about how Trump and the Russians are conspiring to sell our democracy to Putin and the oligarchs. And apparently, all of us end up in a gulag somehow. Is that actually what's happening?
Yeah, it's a really bizarre situation, Jim, where you have people who were working really closely with the Russians before and who never objected to Kremlin meddling in American politics as long as it benefited them. All of a sudden, they're pointing the finger at Donald Trump, saying he's part of this big Putin conspiracy to destroy our country.
Yeah, you know, I wonder, I guess, if it's just pure politics, if it's opportunism, if it's both. But we do need to at least be clear. The Russians are a problem. They're not our friends. They've been messing with us, whether they're messing in somebody's favor and they don't care or whatever reason, they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. You know, they have a goal. They have imperial aspirations as always. And we should definitely take Russian meddling serious. But I guess my concern is the idea that this is somehow collusion between Trump and his associates and Putin. I'm sorry, I'm not buying that.
No, it's a lot of foolishness on the part of some people around President Trump, and then a lot of maliciousness on the side of his opponents. And Putin's just taking advantage of it, like really any good political leader should.
And they're the masters of this. I mean, if there's one thing, you know, the Russians and before when they were the Soviets and the Russians before that have always been good at, it's intrigue and propaganda and backstabbing and spying and the entire thing. And especially through the Soviet years, they perfected the arts of political warfare and information operations and false flags and all of this. So the idea that Putin, who was deep in the intelligence apparatus, would not be using this now, of course he is. But let's be clear about it. What is he actually trying to accomplish? Do you think it's just destabilization?
Yeah, I mean, first, Russia is very weak. Putin's rule is very weak. It's much weaker than it looks. So it's to his benefit to keep all of us edgy and confused and fighting each other. And so he's happy to see NATO countries go after one another. He's happy to see us Americans fighting against each other. He wants us to lose confidence in our institutions because he can win. As long as we Americans stop trusting all the parts of our government that are supposed to keep us safe from our enemies, he wins.
And he
and
looks
as long
bigger
as people
too.
Do stupid things, absolutely, he looks bigger at home and that gives him more power.
Yeah,
so every time Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and others say Putin this, Putin that, and they see a Putin under every rug, they're giving Putin much more power. And this is what he wants. Sure, if he can control the president of the United States, he's the kingmaker here. And just yesterday you had somebody from the Democrat Party saying that literally now Putin picked Donald Trump as president and Hillary lost because of Putin's intrigue. Not because she was a terrible candidate and people really hated her, but because Putin did this. So now you're having this, the best narrative the KGB could ever engineer was that the strongman of Russia can now dictate who's president of the United States. And unfortunately, our friends in the Trump administration have not done a good job at all about clarifying this, and they've only muddied the waters by because they have so much to contend with in making this transition.
There are folks in Trump's orbit who are sketchy. I mean, Paul Manafort is an oligarch supporter. You know, he literally has been working with some of the bad guys over there. Not that there are any real good guys. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, there are plenty of people who do business over there. And if you do business in Russia or in the states around Russia where Russia has influence, you're dealing with the Russian state. You're dealing with the intelligence agencies. You're dealing with the oligarchs who run that crime syndicate. So, you know, to some extent, finding dirt on someone who's done any business in that area is not particularly complicated, and it shouldn't really be surprising.
Not at all. Anybody who's going to go over there has to dirty their hands somehow, because Russia's just a dirty place to work. But Paul Manafort is not someone who you think of when you think of the word integrity anyway. the fact that Donald Trump didn't say, to hell with you, get out of here, I have nothing to do with you, is really surprising. But the thing is, Donald Trump is loyal to people who've been loyal to him. So you've got to give the man credit for loyalty, because it's been very much to the president's detriment. This whole Manafort thing has been a huge distraction for him. And the Russians have been just having a blast keeping Trump off track.
Well, we're talking with Mike Waller, vice president here at the Center for Security Policy. Now, Mike, the larger game, okay, aside from the fact that the Democrats are willing to throw the United States under the bus and our ability to operate a government and to, you know, work on the world stage because they hate Donald Trump and they don't want to give up the control they've had for the past 8 years. Let's look at what Russia's ambitions are larger than, you know, now we've given Putin this kingmaker status. We've, you know, put him back into play as one of the big dogs. Obviously, Syria is an area where they have held sway. Their puppet is supported there. Are there other places, you know, Ukraine, Crimea seems to be owned now. Are there other places where they're going to put the pressure on? Is it Europe and NATO? Where do you think?
Well, yeah, they're doing a lot in Europe and NATO now. They have troops massed up on the Norwegian border up in the Arctic, right along Finland. You have some of the strongest members of NATO concerning Russia are not even NATO members. They're Finland and Sweden, of all places. And they sound like Ronald Reagan when you talk to the Finnish leadership about the problems in Russia there. So the Russians are putting pressure there. They're, of course, putting pressure on Ukraine, which is not a NATO ally, and it's got a lot of problems of its own. But it's Ukraine is certainly friendly to the United States. And thanks to President Bill Clinton, who said if Ukraine unilaterally disarmed its nuclear arsenal and gave it back to the Kremlin, then we would guarantee Ukraine's territorial integrity. So as a nation, we have an arrangement with Ukraine where, okay, you guys unilaterally disarmed, so we will look after you, and we turned our back on them. Russia is working a lot with Iran now. Just today, they signed we worked out an arrangement with Iran so that Iran will let Russia use its military bases for whatever purposes, you know, yet unexplained. So that's a big, big deal. And then you have Russia building relations with Saudi Arabia and some other Arab states where they never had relations before, because the Arabs were so freaked out about what the Obama administration did with this secret Iran deal. So Russia's really stirring the pot now, and they've got troops now in Egypt and Libya, which they did not have before, special operations forces there. So they're really causing a mess in that whole periphery of Eastern Europe, Central Asia, Mideast, and North Africa. And of course, even in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, they have a naval presence there like not even the Soviets had. They've got nuclear attack submarines patrolling in the Gulf of Mexico, right off Florida and New Orleans and Texas.
You know, I think we can, I will throw a good chunk of that at Obama's lack of leadership. And as you mentioned, his coddling of the mullahs in Iran and paying them off and giving them the Iran deal. And now we've got, you know, the Russians as one of the kingmakers in that region and assisting the Iranians in doing it. So the Russians were bombing for a while out of the Iranian air bases. Is this bigger than that?
Yeah, this is giving Russia expanded rights to Iranian military facilities. And of course, Russia has been providing Iran with nuclear weapons technology and missile technology all along. And we've been pretending that it wasn't really the Russians that were doing this.
Well, Mike Waller, Vice President, Center for Security Policy, thank you for keeping an eye on this. Russia is not going away. Putin's not going away. And the world is a dangerous place. This is Jim Hansen. That's going to wrap it up for Secure Freedom Radio today. Frank Gaffney will be back tomorrow with more ammunition for you in the war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.